the afternoon session. Lots of the people in the room have brought fascinating leaflets that further events will be of interest to you. So I urge you to find out about Haying for It, 6th or 8th of March in Worcestershire. This leaflet. Psychoanalysis, Trauma and Military Mental Health, which is coming up soon on the 18th of October, and is another day conference about new directions in understanding and treatment. Courtesy of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, there are free books for everyone who wants one, Poets of the Great War, so they're on the table outside. So many more leaflets, but have a look at the outside. But I also just wanted to draw your attention to this next event, The Pity, which is on National Poetry Day on Thursday, which features a new poem by Denise Riley, who you'll hear from this afternoon, and also from three other new writers, Steve Eli, Zappa Kunyal, and Wharton Shire, and these are contemporary responses to World War I and war today, right up to the present Syrian moment. So you pick up that as well. This afternoon is going to be chaired by David Morgan. David Morgan is a psychoanalyst, a consultant psychotherapist, as I'm sure many of you know, and his specialisms are whistleblowing, politics, and war. And yeah. David, for the afternoon, David Morgan.
I just come from a conference on war entitled Shall We Bomb or Not? Not to bomb or not to bomb? What is the question?
I'm now going to segue into poetry.
May have the answer. Maybe not. So I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Denise Riley. Lives in London, teaches at the UEA. She wrote War in the Nursery, and by that name, Feminism in the Category of Women in History, The Words of Cells, Identification, Solidarity and Irony, The Force of Language, the Jean-Jacques Leclerc, Personal Passion, Language as Affect, Time Lived Without Its Flow, and has published a collection of poetry including Penguin Modern Poets, number 10, Douglas Oliver and Ian Sinclair, and Denise Riley Selected Poems 2000. In 2012, she was awarded the Best Single Poem by Forward Poetry Prize for a part song. So, Denise, congratulations.
Yes, thank you to everybody for coming back in the hour of the dormouse. It is 2 o'clock. And I should warn you that I have been given an entire 50 minutes to hold forth, and I should warn you that I have no embellishment, no interlocutor, no graphics, no cartoons. And I'm going to speak, or rather, because I'm no good at all at spontaneous utterings, I'm going to read Time Rhyme and Stopped Time. When someone very close to you, like in my case, one of my children, has died suddenly and unexpectedly, it's likely that at least one kindly and well-meaning person will advise you to reread Freud's Morning and Melancholia. This is inevitable. But less prescriptive and more sympathetic than that essay is the older Freud's remark in his letter to a friend, written after the death of his daughter Sophie. Although we know that after such a loss, the acute state of mourning will subside, we also know we shall remain inconsolable and will never find a substitute, no matter what may fill the gap. Even if it be filled completely, it nevertheless remains something else. And actually, says Freud, this is how it should be. It is the only way of perpetuating that love which we do not want to relinquish. So, the gap, even though, as Freud says, it may be filled up, will remain detectable. It stays as something else. It is noticeable, precisely as a filled gap, which is as good as it gets. In other words, what is replaced is never identical to what's been lost. It's that very action of replacing which can stay so prominent in our minds. And now I'm going to make what sounds strangely to suggest that the same happens in the case of rhymed verse and its paused and then resumed internal time. You stop, you repeat, you continue, you repeat slightly differently. You stop, you go ahead. Like a version of Beckett's, I can't go on, I'll go on, I can't go on, I'll go on. Or indeed, Beckett, something is taking its course. But with a variant, something is being carried on. The familiar, but then the differing in the next breath, which is exactly what happens both in rhyme and in your own gradual reanimation, so to speak, after you've come very close to the death of someone you were very intimate with in life. Nothing has changed, and yet it all has. You are returned after your brush with another's death, a brush that seems to have stopped you too. And you return differently. You return knowing more. The repeating sounds of rhymed words are close, but of course they're not identical. So in a rhyme, and also in a repeated cadence, something can be guaranteed by definition to return. Of course there's also a whole sonic apparatus at work in poetry, including couché metre. I won't go into this today, but for anybody who's interested in the critic, Simon Jarvis has got a very nice essay on this, just called Why Rhyme Pleases. It's true to the nature of many returns, including your own return from your proximity to another's death, that it won't be an arrival at the very same place. You yourself would not be the same. Something stays recognizable. It's recognition as recognition. To know or to be known again, but because of the inevitable pause or interval, to know or to be known a bit differently. There is an inbuilt recognition of change, but that change can't be a replacement by the same thing any more than it can be a literal restoration of the lost object. Any rhyme carries a slight shift in its sound. It stays distinct enough, however, to preserve the trace of the original rhyming word. So rhyme brings about our recognition of a familiar term, not of an exact identity. It's somewhat altered, but it's still familiar. Rhyme fills the gap which the listening ear anticipates and fills it with something close to the original but not the same. Another way of saying this, rhyme offers a preserved outline of the sonic gap that will remain in the ear even after it's been filled in by another rhyme. Rhyme and cadence keep the outline intact and they proffer to the gap something which does not, however, obliterate, to return to Freud, which does not obliterate its true and necessary standing as a gap. This gap is no melancholic shortcoming. The gap is needed for the prosody, for the mechanics of the poem, to work at all. Exactly like Freud's letter, no matter what may fill the gap, I quote again, even if it is to be filled completely, it nevertheless remains something else. And actually, this is how it should be. Close quote. But then this movement through time of the poem needn't be linear. It may well be marked by oscillation, a to and fro, rather than any forward-leaning chronological drive. The poem, that is, both sanctions and itself enacts an experience of time which isn't linear. And your own experience time in the immediate wake of the sudden unexpected death of someone to whom you were very close is not linear either. But that lack of the usual forward flow in your experience of temporal perception is not, I'd want to insist, well understood if it's interpreted, however sympathetically, as a pathology, let alone as a kind of psychosis. I know that what I've just said might sound like a rather capricious comparison between the workings of rhyme and the experience of living through another's death, where you were very close to the dead person, where you loved that person. But, and I'm now preempting my own reflections about rhyme and time, my hunch is that rhyme may do the work of holding time together, of making a chain of stitches in sound, which, although each stitch must be slightly different, the whole can act as a sonic link across time. And so it can enact for you that feeling of sequence, which otherwise would have been mislaid, if your usual temporal experience flow has been cut through by another's death. I'll explain in a moment what I mean by such cut in the usual apprehension of the flow of time. But first I'll read a poem, one, if you can forgive me, one of my own. Not for its content at this stage, not for any meaning, but just so that you can get used to the formal design, the structure of it, which is dead plain. It's called You Men Who Go in Living Flesh. You men who go in living flesh, scour clean, then drape your souls in plumy dress that they may rise clear of those thrashing shoals of mackerel of the sea who call you lotterers on the strand to heed your future salted lungs pegged out to dry on sand. I was upright upon the land, another thing in the sea. Its light has washed my eyelids shut, green grass floats over me. Hope is an inconsistent joy, yet blazes to renew its lambent resurrections of those gone ahead of you. And now I read something more argumentative, which does lay out some thoughts about rhyme, time, and mortality, but it keeps exactly that same hymn-like or ballad-like formal structure of partly rhymed quatrains as the piece that I've just read. And the next piece, the piece which contains thought, so to speak, is Death Makes Dead Metaphor Revive. Death makes dead metaphor revive, turn stiffly bright and strong. Time that is felt as stopped will freeze its to-fro, pro-to song I parrot under feldspar rock, sunk into chambered ice. Language, the spirit of the dead, may mouth each utterance twice. Spirit as echo clowns around in punning repartee, since each word overhears itself, laid bare, clairaudiently. An Orphic engine revs but floods, choked on its own weight. Disjointed anthems dip and bob now, down time's defrosted spate. Over its pools of greeny melt, the rearing ice will tilt. To make rhyme chime again with time, I sound a curious lute. I wrote both of the two pieces that I just read with an ear to the kind of affect that swells up from the boxy hymn quatrains of Isaac Watts. I was wondering about the automated nature of the feeling that can shine through rhyme. That is, about rhyme's own capacity to generate feeling, or we could say thinking feeling hyphenated. There's an obvious impersonality about rhyme. Its sound resemblances aren't meaning resemblances, or not usually. And yet rhyme is, in the same breath, deeply personal in its indwelling in the listener, like a marriage of the material and the ideal. And at the same time, the sheer contingency of a particular language of what rhymes with what is never far away from our minds. And it's a very happy and a curious accident of the English language that the word rhyme does indeed itself rhyme with the word time. And indeed, that both words rhyme with chime, a word which itself means a sonic repetition. So when the speaker of my last poem, Death Makes Dead Metaphor Revive, says, to make rhyme chime again with time, I sound the curious lid, she had something specific in mind about the severance of time and its potential joining again by rhyme. I'll describe what I mean by such severance in a moment. But I want to make it clear that I'm not suggesting that there is a therapeutics or a curative aspect to rhyme. It can't mend the divorce or the split between the usual forward movement of time and the person who, after a death, may find herself caught in a perceived standstill. Nor am I following behind that very interesting work on sound, done, for instance, by the French musicotherapist and psychologist Edith Lecoux. And all her memorial poems, which are both strongly metrical and rhymed, are what people seem, quote, instinctively, unquote, to turn to when they're in search of what to read as a funeral, my suggestion is not that there's a cure, or indeed much of a consolation, for loss to be had in the formally structured poem. But, to use an old-fashioned word, such a poem, I think, can work as an emblem, a kind of sounding emblem. Okay, then, emblematic of what? Of an experience of loss, which is by now beginning to be no longer quite paralyzed and no longer at an eternal standstill. Of the fact that there is change. You know you've been changed yourself by your proximity to the death of some intimate, like your child. But there's also a return. This return is not to the same. There's a recognition of change in you, not a replacement, but something which can recollect in its sound what had gone before. And so now I want to try to bring this idea of alteration plus recognition closer to a lived experience of halted time. So what do I mean by mentioning this severance of time? It's something like this. And I'm going to be drawing but briefly on a very short book of mine called Time Lived Without Its Flow. Because I'm assuming that most people in this room won't have come across this. So if you happen to be someone who has, please forgive me for this implication of something you already knew. So just to explain what I mean, to outlive the sudden death makes it evident that your ordinary time, which had once flowed, had never been all that much of a clear stream. That old kind of time had always been thick. It must have been another aspect of the flesh of the world. Now, though, after the death, your distinctive sensation of a newly stopped time, or rather a non-time, has blown away that old and unremarked thickness and has instead dropped you down in a landscape of brilliant clarity. So perhaps yours might be a version of akinetopsia, that rare psychical condition in which you mislay the perception of motion, like the patient who found pouring out a cup of tea difficult because the fluid appeared to her to be frozen like a glacier. Rather than being only a temporary swerve, your new post-death state, the death of your intimate, your new state is stepping outside of that entire sheltering sky of temporality itself into a not unpleasant state of tremendous simplicity, of easy candor and bright emptiness. Its perception as bodily immediate is a feeling of thirst. Your altered temporality, that is, isn't to do with any kind of taking thought. It feels foundational to do with the entire nature of your cognition. A sudden, unexpected vanishing into death smashes through your own survivor's habitual assumption that people will reappear. Someone who says, "I keep expecting to hear his key in the door at any moment," isn't falling back on the cliche. She's issuing a factual report on her state. Once so ferociously shaken up, cognition can't readily regroup its forces with its old anticipation intact. Your entire stance is changed by an upheaval of the pre-conscious topography in which your old apprehension of the world had once quietly moved. You may, in effect, go with the lost person into timeless time. This experience may be the time of the dead, or rather, it's as near as you, the living, can approach to entering into that time which is simultaneously non-time. I want to qualify this quickly by saying, so to speak, your own changed intuition of time, so hard, I know, to describe aloud convincingly, is echoed in that stumbling grammar about the being of the dead. The very grammar of discussing a death falters. Even the plainest "he died" is an odd sentence, since there's no longer a human subject to sustain that "he," while the language, of course, must go on behaving as if it is. What about the phrase "his body," once there's no longer any live "he" to animate and own it? The writer Lydia Davis has a lovely piece that she calls "Grammar Questions on Justice." She writes, "When he is dead, everything to do with him will be in the past tense. Or rather, the sentence, 'he is dead,' will be in the present tense. And also questions such as, 'where are they taking him?' or 'where is he now?' But then I won't know if the words 'he' and 'him' are correct in the present tense. Is he, once he's dead, still he? And if so, for how long is he still he? Nevertheless, of course, such daily curios of expression as "he's died" are readily shuffled along with. They're pragmatically workable. Far more linguistically intractable, though, is the effort to show the condition of what I'm calling stopped time. For once there's no longer a feeling of sequence, because your own sensation of flowing time has been destroyed. Narration itself can't proceed. Any attempt at descriptive writing is soon at an impasse, where normally it could have relied on its own unfolding. Not so now. A life of no time cannot be recounted. Your very condition militates directly against narrative. The experience of atemporality undercuts its own possibility of articulation. It can't speak itself because all the usual articulations of syntax have been snapped, but not because, as kindly onlookers might reasonably assume, you are too shocked to wish to write, or indeed because you are in denial, but because once the movements of time is arrested for you, so are all those customary befores, nets and afters that underpin narrating. Any sentence slopes forward into its own future, as had your own former intuition of mobile time. In your old inclination towards the future, there is also something that because it shaped your awareness of yourself. Both experience time and your being, in their mutual implication, had lent out towards the world. But now, your newly stopped time is stripped of that kind of directedness. So very little seems to have been published about the effects of sudden death on the experience of time of those left alive. Now, of course, this science isn't at all surprising. Once you think of those structural barriers, linguistic barriers to telling, and indeed your very will to try to recount your violently novel state of timeliness gets sapped, you sense that your most determined effort can't get through to others. You feel that syntax itself is set against you, because syntax must rely on conventional temporality in order to function at all. If time had once ushered you into language, now you come to learn that narrative language had sustained you yourself in time. Its thens and its next had once unfolded themselves placidly. But now that time has abruptly gone away from you, your whole language of telling has left with it. So whatever happens to you once you're thrown outside of time's motion and you find yourself cut away from this mutual implication of language and time, do not say that you have stopped. Because something still goes on. Something still takes its course. You walk about, you might even sleep a little. You do your best to work at your charm, you get older. Yet, in essence, for the duration, you have stopped. Your impression of your own interiority has drained away, and you become pure skin stretched out tightly over vacancy. You abide. I'll read a couple of short stanzas from a long sequence of mine, a kind of elegy called A Part Song. And in the first of these, I was trying to find a visual equivalent for what I'd just been talking about, this sense of arrested time after sudden death. But it was a very frustrating effort for me, for all the reasons that I've just outlined to you. And so my frustrated effort reads, suspended in unsparing light, the sloping gull arrests its curl. The glassy sea is hardened waves, its waters lean through shining air, yet never crash, but hold their arc, hung rigidly in glaucous ropes, muscled and gleaming. All that should flow is sealed, is poised in implacable stillness, joined in non-time and halted in free form. In my second and shorter extract, there's a quick reflection on the impossible hope of such a writing, the writing I've just read. This writing, of course, would like to bring back the dead. It knows it won't. It's all a resurrection song. Could it ever be got right? The dead would rush home keen to press their chinos. The continuing possibility of inverting the no longer existing person induces a curious linguistic quasi-resurrection. As an illusion of grammar, it has its linguistic reasons. Perhaps language, at least, possesses a belief in spirit. No wonder that the puzzles of lost animation or the dream of reanimation become a driving preoccupation among those who are left alive. Those gibbering souls of Orphic myth might suggest that the scattering of the anima is also a syntactical flight. And even the most secular of minds like in fact my own mind, finds it hard to conceive of a death without some kind of continuation, as if in some agnostic's version of a released soul. No linguistic subject can easily be conceived as extinguished, because language itself just will not sustain that thought. Its own trajectory is always to lean forward into life, to push it along, and therefore to propel the dead of whom it speaks onward among the living. I read a last poem of my own. This is called Listening to Lost People, and it reflects on this animation of words through my own thoroughly atheistic belief in the afterlife of language itself. Listening for lost people. Still looking for lost people, look unrelentingly. They died is not an utterance in the syntax of life, where they belonged. No, belong. Reanimate them, not minding if the still living turn away casually. Winds wrap up its skin so the sea tilts from red, blue to blue, red into the puckering water. Go his ashes, who was steadier than these elements, thickness of some surviving thing that sits there, bland, its owner's gone, nor does the idiot howl, while I'm unquiet as a talkative ear. Spring heat, the cherry tree's fresh bronze leaves, fan out and gleam, to converse with shades, yourself, become the shadow. The souls of the dead are the spirit of language. You hear them alight inside that spoken thought. Now I try to get us back to Ryan's relation with stop time. Where's the literature that deals closely with this strange arresting of time I've been talking about? Because it must exist. There's a fairly familiar literature in the 17th century, a poetry of temporal distortion, like the elegist Henry King's poem on Howe after his young wife's death. His own time slowed and went into reverse. This much, though, we're already perfectly familiar with. It's a poetry of the sad distortion of the mourner's time. But what I want to get at is the experience of a radically arrested time and how that can be described as a breaking of sequence. I've been able to unearth one decisive note here, and that's a poem of Emily Dickinson's from about 1864. And the ever-reliable Emily Dickinson writes this: I felt a cleaving in my mind as if my brain had split. I tried to match it seam by seam, but could not make them fit. The thought behind I strove to join unto the thought before, but sequence rattled out of sound like walls upon a floor. And that's it. We know there's an obvious association of sounds and sequences. With any passage of music or simply a scale, one note implies a coming next. Any first sound will lead towards a coming second, anticipating it, promising it. But in Dickinson's piece about some kind of experienced internal splitting, the property of sequence of following has been abstracted, so that now sequence is a noun, a thing, and this new thing has rattled or scrambled itself clean away from sound. It's gone shooting off across the floor like dropped walls of knitting wool. Okay, so far so good. Sound embodied in the poem as a vessel that would usually hold sequence has been emptied off it. But here we're being told that sequence rattled out of sound. What, though, would sound itself become if the possibility of sequence or succession were to abandon it? This wholesale scrambling or rattling in Dickinson's poem seems to imply something genuinely radical for temporal as well as for oral cognition. If sequence were truly to fall away from sound, then we, as its hearers, could no longer rely on any future unrolling of successive sound. Each element, both the sound and the sequence, would, in such a split, become mutually unintelligible in their separation. And their dissociation would sever our whole intuition of normally experienced time, which relies on extension, anticipation, and consequence. The separation of sound from sequence would chip away at our entire faith in consecutive thought. My conviction is that this is exactly what can happen in the aftermath of the unexpected death of someone to whom we are profoundly close. Dickinson's poem asserts that a chain of thought may snap and scatter its elements. If with this we take Hegel's idea of sound as something apt to grip and secure you through sequences of notes, then such a break in continuity would change your entire sense of being, which indeed is what you sense is happening when you come to inhabit the sense of stopped time that I've been trying to describe. The self, Hegel declares, belongs to time as it moves to and fro between its states of self-immediacy and self-separation. Time is the being of the self, so much so that sound's own time, including its vanishing succession of myriad instants, Hegel says, quote, sets the self in motion. And so if, as he proposes, your perceptions of a train of vanishing sounds is germane to your self-sensing, then a disruption of your grasp of sequence would alter your own presence to yourself. Again, I think this is what does happen in the wake of a sudden death. If you're usually embodied and established in a sequence of rhythm, then to be thrown into a state of atemporality with no rhythm and no expectation of futurity, that ensures that you live in a prolonged suspension. That condition is what's been depicted in Emily Dickinson's poem in the phrase, sequence raveled out of sound. And to discover her taut description of this so rarely conveyed, described feeling did come as a great relief to me when I happened to stumble across it. Although to jump forward, the American novelist Don DeLillo, in his 2001 The Body Artist, says something curiously similar. He has a suddenly widowed heroine who has undergone an altered temporal sense of her own after the suicide of her husband. Eventually, she comes to want to find again, and this is a quote from DeLillo, the flow of time in her body to tell her who she was. My tentative suggestion is that these pulsations of a resumed time may be enacted mimetically or emblematically by the returning time of rhyme. And I want to close on a final question. Is there anything specific about how the loss of a child, in particular, will extend to your usual scope of felt time, well beyond your own skin in this way? If so, perhaps it's this. In the past, you had sensed that your living child's time, including the physically interior time of its gestation, if you are the female parent, as well as its independently growing life, was, as it were, internal to your own time, and you had aged in tandem with its life. But now, after the death, the time of the vanished child has been cut away from your impression of your own internal time, as if from a set of nested Russian wooden dolls, the inner ones had tumbled out. But in the same moment, when your own time stops moving, the dead one comes to re-inhabit it, your arrested time vividly, as an incorporated presence in a shared atemporality. But I would want, in trying to describe this, to dissociate what I'm saying from, indeed, the word dissociation itself, because my brief, if you like, is to argue for an intelligibility in this experience, resistant, though, as I've said, language systematically is to conveying it in a clear form. And it's, of course, in that shared notion of atemporality that you might find that, at least for a while, you must stay there. You might even find, for a while, that you want to stay there. Not out of melancholia, let alone out of a pathologized notion of melancholia, but simply out of companionship with the dead. In your changed perception of time, as it gradually begins to move again, there's a fresh kind of carrying forward. Your gradually returning time is augmented, for the time of the dead is, from now on, contained within your own. And in this respect, if no other, it has much in common with the palimpsest-like time of language itself, especially with the systematically returning time of the rhythmic language of poetry. That's your question. Your patience. I know that was my allotted 50 minutes, so we blame our organisers.
Profound. I think we should almost have a silence afterwards. Putting it into words is almost going to lose something. I was put in mind, I'll go to questions in a minute, but I was put in mind, I worked in the mortuary for a long time with people who did have brackets. I agree the word is wrong, pathological mourning. Some who were catatonic. And the combining thing in all their histories that connected, they'd all lost a child. Mm-hmm. There's a bearable loss possible. And to freeze time and stop time, and not try to put it into words or therapize it or anything, was enormously important. Some people just couldn't move. It was just to put words to it was to make it real. Mm-hmm. So they had to identify with a lost object, as analysts call it, long enough to have people to tolerate just being, as you say, stuck in time with utterly unbearable, inchoate expression. But the only way of expressing it was to stop as well.
Yeah.
And to begin to find words was very important. We brought poets in. They actually brought poetry. Emily Dickinson, when I recognised her, brought poetry workshop.
Really?
And that began to allow some people to move again. And I felt we all found it really I think it's obvious you've struggled with your own loss, and the energy and the creativity you've found through your poetry has helped you move through it. That was very real, I think.
I mean,
oh, sorry, I thought my speaker was on.
Is it on?
Yes. Sorry, I was talking that way. Okay. Any thoughts? Oh, yes.
Thank you, that was really amazing. Completely wonderful to go through. It reminds me of not just like the phenomenology of perception, but the phenomenology of something deeply perceived. And I'm very curious that, having known your work, it's always come across as celebrating fragmentation, celebrating the gap. And it's quite a surprise that in the lack of narrative telling, you're going back to celebrate something which seems to resolve that, like rhyme. And has that come into your writing, or is it just you were using that as a metaphor?
No, it does. It comes in very directly. But it's not, I would say, that rhyme resolves anything, but and I'm not even well, as usual, I'm not convinced by the veracity of what I've been trying to say at all. It's not a thesis, it's only very, very tentative. But I would say that one of the curious properties of rhyme is that it doesn't fill the gap. I mean, coming back to the quotation from Freud's letter about Sophie's death that I began with, what rhyme does is enact and, if you like, ritually embellish or trace the outline. And the Freud quotation was saying that, rather paradoxically, that the gap will remain as a filled gap, but what you will stay, what you may expect to stay conscious of, is not vacancy at the centre, but of the outline. And so what started to interest me were the features of a more formal poetry. In fact, we could say particularly the poetry of 1914 to 1918, where the formal structures and the rhythms, the end rhymes, are pronounced. But I think one way of understanding their pronunciation, so to speak, is as formal emblems of loss reduced to an outline. But an outline, of course, is a sharp thing. An outline is a kind of incision. An outline retains the shape. A blur or a dissolution isn't an outline.
It's going to sound very incoherent compared to what we've just heard, but I just wanted to try and put words to something you generated in me, again, thinking about mothers and infants. And of course, one of the first places rhyme must start is in the echo when a child cries, oh, a mother cries, oh, back, but in a form that, again, contains and modifies. There's a direct rhyme. Of course, when a child dies then, in a sense, that echo, or the echo you provided for that outline, has gone. And I was thinking, when you finish with the atemporality and quiet, why one would choose to stay there? It's about not leaving that cave, even though the echo has ceased. You're still close to that, and remaining close to the lost child, the lost object, yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
No.
was saying really reminded me of the Elizabeth Bishop from the Art of Losing in terms of Ryan coming back, and I wonder just what you thought about that and the idea maybe of a villain out structure even redoubling that the effect of Ryan in that way.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's a very technically brilliant formalization of the question, and indeed that particular piece you mentioned could serve as a good instant of part of what I've been trying to talk about. I mean, my own preference by a long way, though, I have to say, is for the Emily Dickinson, because of the combination in it of extreme formal simplicity and density both of affect and thought, or rather that sort of thought affect fusion that often typifies the best of her work. But I think one practically interesting question, to which I don't know the answer at all myself, is how do we describe the very delicate and gradual process by which the realization of a normal returning flow of time starts to seep back into your consciousness and starts to, if you like, destabilize that crystalline and rather brightly lit feeling of being held in a stopped time where there is no movement. Because apart from the people you were mentioning, there is a sort of ineluctability about that gradual temporal return, although it's a return that does not bring happiness to you because it is a separation.
It's precisely that.
It's a second loss.
And because the returning throughout each time, a doubling is also a splitting, so in the repetition, it's halving in a way as well. It seems as though if you're losing something.
Yes.
You regain your integrity, but at a terrific cost.
Yes. Time has. Is that time?
Yeah.
Don't forget, we've got. We'll go to the museum for continued chats on.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rhymes actually, it's the ridge of the bridge.
His work appears in many anthologies, including Being Human and the favourite book of 20th century Scottish poetry. His three poetry collections are The Apple Ghost, Undark and Grain, in which recurrent themes are absence and transience. Alongside his career as a poet, John worked as an addictions counsellor and a psychiatric nurse. It's a very privilege to be here today.
Thanks very much. I'm in my English grandfather's kitchen. And I'm playing with the cord for the kitchen maid. Remember kitchen maids? There was one above the fireplace, this full-length kitchen maid. You dry the clothes above an open fire. And I'm playing with the cord. And he says, "That's you in your double figures." But I don't even see his face. I can't remember even what the sound of him speaking. I'm looking at the cord for that kitchen maid, and it's like polished pewter, because it's been handled by so many people over so many decades, let it shine. And I can't believe it is so smooth. And there's light coming behind me from the scullery through the door that no longer, that doesn't have a window in it yet, so it's impossible, but that's what I see. And for me, memory is a place like that. I seem to locate them in history. And it symbolises what poetry does for me, because what I'm doing there is something important was being said to me. And it seemed to me, my grandfather was very pompous, and he probably said it in a very pompous way, "No, that's you and your double figures now." But I took this as being something that was extremely important, and what I seemed to do was almost take a photograph of everything that was around me, and it was this cord for the kitchen maid that I remember. And in my poetry, I do the same thing. When I'm wanting to talk about the majestic abstractions, it's something tiny that I'll actually talk about. When the person's over there that is of interest to me in my writing, I'm looking over here. I'm always looking at askance. Remember, Emily Dickinson said, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." You know, so I'm always at a slant the way it's going. And the other thing is that the me in my poetry is always a wee bit of a fiction. You know, there isn't any light coming through the scullery door, because that door hasn't been put in yet, and it won't be for another decade. But it's important that in my own poetry I'm kind of stepping aside a wee bit. You know, if I don't do that in my poem, how can a reader get in and inhabit the space that is the poem? So that little memory is really three of the processes that are going on in my poetry all the time that I'm writing. And the four poems I'll read this afternoon are all, in different ways, memories and, more importantly, memorialisations. That English grandfather was in the First World War. He was a mechanic in the Royal Flying Corps. And his job was to develop the photographs taken by the aerial reconnaissance planes of the Western Front. And he never talked about the war. He never talked about anything about it at all. And the only artifact I remember him having was a pair of flying boots, which he kept in the back kitchen, in a cupboard. And I just remember them being so heavy that when I put them on my feet, I couldn't walk. I think my mother said they were felt, but they were really heavy, thick, flying, First World War flying boots. But he never mentioned the war. And we never talked about it. And something that astonished me was, when I was looking into finding those photographs of the Western Front, because he had a couple that he kept, my sister sent me the album they were in. And I'd looked at this dozens and dozens and dozens of times as a child, looking through, trying to trace family, who people were. What I didn't notice, 60 of those photographs are of men or women in uniform, First World War. And I didn't notice that. It's almost as if the war was a blind spot for me because I've never talked about it. My first poem, though, relates to my Scottish grandfather, whom I didn't know. He died when I was about 2. And a while ago, I was asked to do an update of a Viking poem. It was a project that was being run. Where various poets were readdressing the forums and the subjects of Viking poetry. And I was given one by a wonderful named Egil Skargrimsson. And his poem was called Sonatarek, which means the death of a son. And his son was drowned at sea, and the recompense for the way that Egil got over that was to write poetry. And he was quite a remarkable poet. Viking poets were. History was that he wrote his first poem when he was 3, and he murdered his first man when he was 7. It's So we've changed a wee bit since then. He cleaved them from head to teeth with an axe. Man, like we're cheating in a game. He uses a quite complex form called the Quifahatuar, which I really won't bore you with, but it's 8-line stanzas with alternating 3 and 4 syllable lines, and each pair of lines is linked with alliterated words, plus there are complex kennings, these protracted metaphors that come again and again through the poem. And I wanted to do this in a modern way that hopefully wouldn't read too Viking. And it was a bit like trying to zip on a pair of trousers that are 4 sizes too small. In fact, to get it on a page, I've had to do it landscape because they're so etiolated, it just drops away into nothing. The family story in that, which I decided to use because it seemed to fit so perfectly, was my Scottish grandfather's. My uncle Alexander, by far the oldest of his 8 children, was killed on the 4th of November 1918, same day as Wilfred Owen, Battle of the Sombre Canal. He was in the Royal Field Artillery, and one of the few pieces of information we have was that the artillery piece they were using blew up. Probably was too hot, firing it too much, and he was killed, died of his wounds. Another piece of information we got was that my grandfather had to sign a release to let him join the army because he was too young. He was 19 when he was killed. And that's really about it. Manu is buried in France. None of the family ever went to the grave. I haven't yet seen a photograph of him. There are no photographs in the house. And my wife and I were the first member family to go, I think, in 2010. So this is my grandfather's Viking grieving for his lost son, the lost boy. November and nothing said, the old world whittling down to winter, ice on my tongue, its wordless, numbing welcome. We bloody believed in war. We cheered when our children sailed off for the front, but now all language fails me. Listen. Army Form B-104, November 1918. A report has been received from the field, France. Killed in action. There. Alexander has been killed. My puthy boy. 19, looked more like 14. They told me his howitzer was shattered, a shell hooked off in the breach, and the blast tore them apart. They were too keen, of course, boys blown to pieces with the great war days from one, boom and gone. I'm a blacksmith. I've seen what white-hot metal makes of flesh. My wee Alec. I'm to blame. I was the fool who signed, and him still far too young, 15. His mother flung her mug at me, mute with rage. Each morning, she makes his bed, lays fresh clothes across a chair. She'll not speak his name again. Her stare is a hard black slow. If fine rhymes rang like iron hammered bright, hot with meaning, they might have weighed more in my heart. Brave songs don't bring the dead home. They damn them to cross that dour black stream where yon pale boatman waits, and foul foundry spit and silence is their only song. When we go to his grave, I'll bring sorrel, because I know the dead are always droothy, their dry mouths clotted with dust. I'll say, sorry, son, this plant slakes just the one small thirst. May its brief white blossom linger upon your grave like snow. And the other fact that I forgot about was that my father always said his mother heard that the war was over and then that her son was dead. So it was just too too close together. Earlier this year I was asked to write a piece based on a painting by Sir Herbert Gunn that's in the wonderful Fleming collection in Mayfair. It's a collection of Scottish paintings through the ages. Absolutely fantastic. And it's a fascinating painting. It's titled The Eve of the Battle of the Somme. And I've used it in school groups. When I'm teaching school groups, I'll say, pass this round and pretend you're the painter. What would you title this painting? The top of the painting, the background, is just a tiny hint of tents. The mid-ground, completely taken up with a mill pond with swimmers in it, and some swimmers lazy on the grass in the foreground. And most of the groups will say, oh, it's called The Swimmers, or it's called Our Summer Holiday. And then they say, well, have a look closer, and actually look around the outside. And then they notice there's a wee 1916 sign, and they say, oh, it's the army camp or something. But the painting itself is very little hint of what the horrors that run in the background are. The horrors of the next day, in fact. I've tried to copy that format in the poem because it seemed to me intensely symbolic that the little strip in the background, barely noticeable, is the world as it really is, the army camp. The vast amount of the painting taken up with this crossing of water, which is highly symbolic, and in the foreground, one of these swimmers lying in the grass, and if you can look at the painting itself, you'll notice that the shadows are red in the palm of his hand. All the details in this painting come from Forgotten Voices of Somme, or that wonderful book by Martin Middlemiss, The First Day on the Somme. I have the word Minnenwerfer in it, which is just an anti-trench mortar, which had a very steep trajectory, so it would drop into trenches, and there wasn't very much you could do to avoid them. So they would have a man on lookout who would blow a whistle when he heard them come over. They came over very slowly, they would kind of tumble over. And there's a little quote from Shelley Skylark in here as well. The big push. Would you believe it? There's a bloke out there singing When You Come to the End of a Perfect Day. His audience, a 60-pounder crew, stand round bleeding from the ears. The Boche are all but finished, apparently. I heard they're packing old clock parts into trench mortars now for want of iron scrap. Some wag quips, the next time he's sentry and hears the plop of a Minnenwerfer tumbling over, he'll not blow the alarm, he'll shout, time, gentlemen, please. We laugh and for one heartbeat forget to be afraid. Bravery and cowardice are just two workings of the same fear, moving us in different ways. The 8th East Surreys have been given footballs to kick and follow at 0 hour. It's to persuade them from the trenches lest their nerve fail as they advance on Montauban. I've watched men hitch up their collars and trudge forward as if shrapnel and lead were no worse than a shower of winter rain. This afternoon, a few of us went swimming in the mill dam behind camp, just for a while, to have no weight, to go drifting clear of thought and world was utter bliss. A skylark climbed high over the torn fields on its impossible thread of song, like an unbodied joy. I don't know why, but it reminded me of the day we took over from the French along the Somme. It was so tranquil, so picturesque. The German trench works, crowded with swathes of tiny, brilliant flowers none of us could name. I believe if the dead come back at all, they come back green, to grow from the broken earth and drink the gathered water, and all the things they suffered will mean no more to them than the setting in of the ordinary dark or a change of weather. I'm going to read another film poem without film attached to it. This one, film's not been made yet, but a Dutch friend asked me if I would provide the words to go with the film she'd already made, which I found a wee bit daunting. But it turned out to be a film of vague people moving against a changing background. Indistinct, sometimes there's water there sometimes what looked like hills. And so it actually gave me great latitude. But there were things going on at that time that got their way into the poem. And so actually I had all but completed this poem before I really knew what it was about. The first one was that the filmmaker herself, she was talking about moving back from Antwerp to Amsterdam. She said, no, it's where I grew up, so it's good to go back. But isn't it strange that when you go back to a place, you're not the same, and it's not the same, and it's actually stranger than places you've never been before in your life. And so she was always having trouble settling back in. And that journey had been a difficult journey for her. And the other thing that was happening at the same time, and I almost never write about so-called big issues because the words you need to describe them are so small that they're almost silence. But there were things going on in East Ukraine in July that hit the headlines quite a lot. And one especially. And it involved a lot of Dutch people, as we know. This is called The Walkers. As soon as we had died, we decided to walk home. A white tattered flag marked where each journey began. It was a slow business. So much water to be crossed, so many dirt roads followed. Each step, we stepped alone. You must understand, we can never be passengers anymore. Even the smallest children had to make their own way to their graves, through acres and acres of sunflowers, somehow no longer pretty. A soldier cradled a cigarette, a child's toy, and his gun, but didn't see us pass. Our light was far too thin. We skirted villages and cities, traced the meanderings of rivers, but beyond it all, the voices of our loved ones called. So we flowed through borders like the wind through railings. And when impassable mountains barred our way, soared above their peaks like clouds, like gulls, like gusts of rain. In time, the fields and woods grew weary, and the sea began. You could tell we were home by the way our shadows leaned. We gathered like crane flies in the window light of familiar rooms, grieving for all the things we never again would hold. Forgive us for coming back. We didn't travel all this way to break your hearts. We came to ask if you might heal the world. I'll finish off with a short poem which is an elegy from my father, who fought in the Second World War, although fought is not quite the right verb, because the one thing he said he was really proud of was that he never actually used his rifle in the entire time he was in the war. He was captured in Crete and interned in the German Sudetenland for 4 years in a labour camp. And it affected him. I didn't realise it when I was young, but it affected him more than any of us could have anticipated. My mother said later, after he was dead actually, she said, it was 2 years before he could sleep in a bed. He slept on the bedroom floor. And several years before he could actually work indoors, he did various jobs. More comfortable not being in houses. And he came back from the war, and he'd obviously seen some quite difficult things, but he came back saying what wonderful people the Germans were. They'd been treated really well by the Germans. He said, although he said, if you were Russian, it was different. So it had been a quite traumatic time. When I'm talking about my poetry, I say that my mother and father are in every poem that I write, and people's faces drop. They say, God. What I mean is in the process. My mother was highly literate. She read loads. She recited poetry to me when I was 3 or 4. Late Aunt Jenny kissed me. It's the first poem I remember. She was emotionally articulate, a wonderful woman, and taught me how to do cryptic crosswords. My father was Scottish, and he'd been through the war, and it was the most difficult thing was to establish any sort of relationship with him. So I feel that the words in my poetry come from my mother, and the white spaces, this is my dad, all this stuff, you know. And if it hadn't been for him and the war, I'd probably been a novelist now. My elegy to him is based on a wonderful conceit. I have a friend who's an artist, and he was explaining to me how an etching works. He says, the great thing about etching is you're getting rid of stuff all the time. You know, you're working from a ground, and you're scouring out, and you're using acid to burn it. It's where you remove the background that the ink will stick. And if you don't get rid of that, there'll be nothing there. And that wonderful paradox is what fueled the poem. The etching that he'd shown me was one of Woods Behind Dundee, and I had walked in them many times with my father. I mean, he loved being outdoors, and we did a lot of walking when I was young, and that's the closest I ever got to. But the strange thing is, in the early drafts of this poem, there's a large central stanza which is a description of these walks from my father. And the more I worked on the poem, and the more I revised it, the less he appeared, until in its final version, he persists only just as 2.5 pronouns. That's all he is. Etching of a line of trees. In memoriam, John Goodfellow Clendy. I carved out the careful absence of a hill, and a hill grew. I cut away the fabric of the trees, and the trees stood shivering in the darkness. When I had burned off the last syllables of wind, a fresh wind rose and lingered. But because I could not bring myself to remove you from that hill, you're no longer there. How wonderful it is that neither of us managed to survive, when it was love that surely cooled the bar, and love that gnawed its own shape from the burnished air, and love that shaped that absent wind against a tree. Some shadow's hands moved with my hands, and everything I touched was turned to darkness, and everything I could not touch was light. Thanks very much. That's what I always say. A good poem is a question. I mean, someone once defined a poem as a little machine for remembering itself, but that's all it remembers. It just remembers itself. I actually brought the album, the photo album of grandfathers, with all these men in uniform, because I couldn't believe that I hadn't spotted them before. I want to have a look at it.
really intrigued by what you said about your dad being in a white space. Gaps and what is missed and what is left out. So I just wondered if you could expound upon that a bit more, because we've had lots of gaps appearing today. Gaps where poets pause before they read the next line, or gaps in how we process something traumatic and how we then tell that story back again. I have to fess up as a poet, so I would love to hear about a bit more about the white space in your poetry, and both sonic gaps as well, pausing, and just how that fits into when you write a poem. What role does the gap?
The gaps in the poetry are things that appear as I rework them, because. You know what it's like when you write a poem, you start off by saying everything you want to say, and then you realise the whole point of the poem isn't to say it all wise, let somebody else say it. And so the gaps are really politenesses. They're my way of leaving a space in the poem for the reader to inhabit it a little bit. And my mother was the one that always filled the silences, because when you think about it, silences are always owned. There's always ownership of a silence. Like this one.
Yeah.
That was me stepping in. So.
Who do you think owned the silence before anyone asked a question? Because there's a tension in any silence, and I think there's a shared sense of ownership.
Yeah. I'm the world's worst for silences. I did a person-centered counselling course like 20 years ago, and used to have the group sensitivity meetings where everyone's having this huge circle, and there would be absolute silence, you know, and I would say, right, today, and that's not going to be me, I'm not going to say anything.
The tension.
And I would sit, and then my foot would start going, and it would last about 30 seconds, and I have to say something. But it says a lot about me.
But I'll say in relation to your father, he didn't speak.
He didn't speak, no.
That silence must have reminded you of him.
I was telling someone a story at lunchtime of my father working in the garden in Moneyfeith where I grew up, and I was out with him, and one of the villagers that knew him but wasn't a close friend, and most of it was his family that were close friend, walked past and stopped at the gate and went, "Hi jockey, how are you this morning?" And my dad put his hoe, his rake down, and just walked into the house without looking around and closed the door.
Psychoanalytically, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
People who have experienced real trauma and loss unconsciously transfer it onto the audience, onto other people.
Yeah.
So at that moment, he left, and they had to experience silence. Where he must have experienced his abandonment and loss in the concentration camp. So people who have lost somebody often just don't get rid of all their friends and disappear. As the friends thinking, what happened? It was obvious what happened, though, getting rid of their loss to their friends. It's then friends who then mourn them. That's the beginning of something. Yeah. So your dad was doing that all the time, every time he turned away. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was, where's he gone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about the poem where the ghost asked the question at the end, is, you know, will you heal? And I wanted as a poet to feel that responsibility to heal.
Gosh, that's a difficult one. I don't think I do. I think my responsibility as a poet is to write in a way that it leaves the reader asking questions of what's going on and interrogating what's being accepted as the way things should be. And that's what my responsibility is. I never think of a poet as being therapeutic in any way or having a role in healing. Some of it probably would be quite upsetting to the reader, I don't know. But I think that's its role, is to make people question what things are and what things aren't. And the good poetry that I read, I hope it makes me.
I think it is therapeutic for some of us. That you are able to put into words inchoate feelings that the rest of us might have. And that's a relief to find they can be symbolised.
Yeah, and I certainly feel better for writing poetry. The American poet Kay Ryan, somebody asked her about it, what poetry does, she said, poetry puts a little more oxygen into the atmosphere.
Exactly.
And is that feel? It's quite stuck in here now after my reading through, isn't it?
Right, I think we go to whatever, but perhaps we'll have time for discussion at the end to bring it all together, or not to bring it all together.
Maybe
but,
thank you.
We're back at 4 o'clock.
No, we have, if we can get back to 10 past.
10 past 4.